pleased indeed welcome Professor Kurt Jakobsen to us today, who's our visiting scholar here at OCHS for this term. He's a professor of the history of religions at the University of Bergen and a member of the Norwegian Academy of Sciences, of Arts and Sciences. And he's been researching earlier on in his an earlier incarnation in Samkhya and Yoga, and indeed wrote a book, if I remember, on Yoga and Miraculous Powers. And he's the author of many volumes, both single-authored and edited volumes. And most recently, the Brill's Encyclopedia of Hinduism, which he edited over a long period, well, not that long actually, but it's many, many volumes now, I think. So it's a mammoth task. And he's also the editor of the online version of that work. And most recently, the Handbook of Hinduism in Europe, a two-volume work that we do have in the library here somewhere. And that's a real achievement, I think, of coordinating all the people that contributed to that. That must have been a nightmare. So I think that's a fine work, something to be proud of. So I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Jakobsen to us today, and he's going to be talking to us this afternoon about early pilgrimage traditions in South Asia.
So thank you for this warm introduction, and thank you for the invitation to the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. I was asked to give two lectures, and I thought I would give those on pilgrimage and do one at each extreme end, one at the beginning, how early we can trace it, and the second one is on Hindu pilgrimage to pilgrimage places outside of South Asia. So then the kind of the extension of Hindu sacred space to the whole world, which is a process going on. My slides are basically my lecture notes, so I have hardly any photos. I'm not an art historian. I think an art historian could give a very different lecture on this, but I don't want to pretend to be an art historian, so I'm not doing that. So my presentation is then about the institution of Hindu pilgrimage in South Asia, and it of course touches on many subjects, but I will focus on the phenomenon of sacred sites, that is Tirthas. This is a site thought to have some properties that attracts visitors for religious reasons from beyond the local or even the regional areas, thus involving that kind of travel, pilgrimage travel. And rituals and ideas of rewards in forms of healing, economic welfare, religious merit, or liberation from bad forms of rebirth, either a better rebirth or liberation from rebirth. It is an interesting historical question then how we have Hindu pilgrimage, because it represents an interesting way of reversal of the Vedic tradition. In the Vedic tradition, the gods were invisible beings moving in the air, and they traveled to where humans were for their sacrifices. But in the pilgrimage tradition, then on the other hand, gods are permanent present at certain sites, and humans then have to travel to where the gods are. So then a good question then is how this reversal happened. This is an interesting historical question and for understanding Hindu pilgrimage. Now, in the Vedic text older than the Mahabharata, there is no mention of specific pilgrimage sites, pilgrimage rituals, or pilgrimage priests in the Vedic text. Although rivers were considered sacred and taking a purifying bath in sacred rivers was known, there is no evidence of particular spots being treated as tirthas, with ritual specialists serving as pilgrimage priests. and it's well known in Jaskas Nirukta on etymology. It does not mention Tirtha in the meaning of specific pilgrimage spot, but only in the context of rivers. And in the Dharmashastra literature, there is no elaborate description of Tirthas before the Dharma Nibandhas, starting in the 12th century, with the exception of a list of sites for Shraddhas found in Vishnu Smriti. And this text has been used a lot by people writing about pilgrimage because it was had been dated wrongly to the 4th or 5th century, and therefore it was kind of used many times to see the point to the earliest. But Patrick Olivelle has now suggested a much later date, close to the 11th century, and then we are very close to the Dharma Nibandhas. So before then, the Dharmashastra, the 12th century, pilgrimage was not part of Dharma. So then how did it become part of Dharma then? What was this process? Of course, that's a big... Now South Asia is one of the major pilgrimage regions in the world. And the sites represent these powerful presences. And they have sacred narratives of sages, divinities and powers. Now the space has this benefit compared to time, that it seems less changeable. So the narratives, although they happened in the past, the place where they happened is still there. So place has this type of permanency that is used in pilgrimage traditions. A second perspective here is that places become, by religious narratives and powers, spaces become owned by ritual traditions. So to connect a religious narrative to a place is a form of land grabbing, you could say. And this All India pilgrimage described in a Tirtha Yatra Parvan of the Mahabharata, which is the earliest large pilgrim text in the Hindu tradition, can be understood as an attempt to lay claim on this whole geographical space of India then for Brahman rituals. That is, this pilgrimage is imagined then as an parikrama. This has been pointed to by a book long time ago by Patil on the Vayoporana. He calls this the Pandavas Tirtha Yatra in the Mahabharata, like a holy campaign. And then to take ownership of the sacred sites within the parikrama. Now the contest for these narratives of Tirtha in the Mahabharata were probably bards. And the narratives are meant for entertaining pilgrims at the pilgrimage places. And the Mahabharata is full of these kind of narratives, often like explaining the name, explaining why there is salvific power at the place, and then giving the etymology in the name of the name. So Kurukshetra, why is it called Kurukshetra? Yes, because Kur was tilling the place. And why is there salvific power there? Well, the gods became afraid that if he continued to till the place, everyone who died there will attain salvation. So the gods are afraid, no one will sacrifice to us anymore. And then they negotiate, and Kuru says that, well, only those who die there who have performed asceticism, and the warriors who die there will attain salvation. And then the gods are kind of happy. And then, so that's the narrative. You can think of the audience. Okay, they have heard the meaning of the place is called Kurukshetra. And then it's also an interesting, different, thinking of the Bhagavad Gita, a different take on that. So clearly this is an entertaining story to entertain pilgrims then. So there are arguments that the bards, in a way, pilgrims became the new audience of the Mahabharata, so the bards, in a way, changed their Mahabharata to entertain this new audience. So what came before this Tirthayatra, then, so it's reasonable to think that it has a non-Vedic origin, since the early Vedic tradition did not have pilgrimage tradition. So Asko Parpola has argued, I don't know if it's convincing, but he has argued that the seals of the Indus civilization were kind of pilgrimage souvenirs. And he has pointed to Mesopotamia, where there were this kind of traditions. So that's a possible difference. Oh, and he also claims that the term Tirtha is of Dravidian origin. Parpola believes that the Indus civilization was a Dravidian civilization. So I'm unable to judge it. It's an interesting, two interesting proposals. I think we are on more safer ground when we talk about this kind of non-Vedic religious rituals in parts of North and Central India associated with sacred trees, pools of water, shrines in the forms of stones, and which might have been objects of pilgrimage, perhaps also with festivals. And these sacred sites were later called Chaityas or Chetyas, sometimes Chaitya Vriksha, tree shrine. And this was associated specifically with groups of trees or a tree. And in a textual tradition, these beings was called then Yakshas or Yakshis. And these beings seem to have been connected to sites around which their worship centered, and which sometimes also had shrines. Maybe the earliest use of this in Pali canon is the Parinibbana Sutta. So the suggestion is that this was widespread, and they were gardens of places and gatekeepers, probably associated with prosperity and fertility. So while the Vedic gods were not connected to sites, these Yakshas and Yakshinis were, and they were protectors, and a worshipper would have to travel to that site in order to worship them. So if people wanted to visit a Yaksha shrine beyond the local, then that would be considered a pilgrimage then. Now, so these shrines and sacred sites had been part of the Indian landscape before the Hindu temple Murtis, which came maybe in the 4th-5th century of the Common Era. So the deities at these non-Vedic shrines were seldom named in the Vedic texts, and the rituals are never detailed. The descriptions of a Chaitya ritual is found then in one text, Ashvalayana Griya Sutra 1.12, so very rare. It says that being present at the Chaitya, one offers a barley, a lump of rice. If the Chaitya is distant, one sends the lump of the rice with a messenger to the place. And if there is a danger involved in the travel, the messenger should also get the weapon. There is also something about a boat, that he should better get the boat if he needs to cross. So, but I'm unsure what that means. He clearly can't carry a boat with him. So. But maybe some promise of getting a boat if he should cross the river. So then this offering was carried to a fixed spot, which could be far away, and then some divinity was present at that spot. Now this Chaitya is important in the Buddhist and Jain tradition, and Mishra, who has studied Yakshas, published a monograph in 1981, he said there is sufficient evidence to prove that many such Chaityas belong to the Yakshas. The Buddha apparently often stayed and preached at such places, and some Viharas monasteries were built on such sites. Buddhists made use of these local deities in order to place themselves within the local society. Cohen argues that the Buddhists, to become localized, they in a way merged with these yakshas or places with yakshas and yakshinis to become local. This was possible precisely because these deities were connected to localities. By associating with these deities, the Buddhists could connect their own presence to the same spot. So he writes, the Buddha and the Sangha become localized insofar as they share their dwellings with the deities who are indigenous and unique to sites of the monasteries. So the argument is that Buddhists used these very consciously to expand their tradition. Mishra is that one by one the different religious traditions made a concerted effort to dislodge and supersede the yakshas. I think in the Hindu tradition, the yakshas was also given often a negative association. So that might have been a way to dislodge them. Kubera was a yaksha, so he was included, but others were, Now the popularity of the yakshas is visible on relics of stupas, which are some of the earliest statues in India, that is after the Hindu civilization, and in stories preserved in the Buddhist texts, and by their presence in the Mahabharata and other Hindu texts, such as Puranas. So this is the only pictures. Now, what's a unique thing with them? This is one of the oldest ones. It's 2.7 meters high. So they were made, that was one way they were pictures at very huge size and the kind of divinity that presides over the productive processes of nature. That's how art historians interpret that. The size then. So I'm unable to judge why it isn't the statue of a human person, a king or something. That I don't know. But I trust the art historians. They say that it's not, that it's a yaksha. And there are several of them, these huge sizes. So, and the yakshis or yakshinis, here is one. They are also clearly then associated with fertility here with the three and the kind of the prosperity of nature, also maybe the beauty of nature. Here is also from also a yakshi associated with a tree then holding the branch. And they are dated by art historians around then the first century before the Common Era. So I can't judge if that is correct or not, or if that would stand, but that's how the current knowledge is. So they were then venerated for fertilities as protectors and guardians, and showed to have been worshipped as such at some pilgrimage places, such as Kurukshetra, also after the sites had become identified with the narratives of Hindu gods. I used the example of Kurukshetra because I have researched much on Kapil Muni, and at Kurukshetra there is a Kapila temple, and Kapila was the name of one of the four protecting yakshas of Kurukshetra. So during history this Kapil identity was changed into the Kapil identity of the Sankhya philosopher, and the temple today is to this Sankhya philosopher, but obviously it is a transfer of a yaksha identity into a Hindu kind of divinity identity. So the yaksha then Matsya Kruka, he owned the lake at the border of Kurukshetra and was recognized as a powerful gatekeeper in the Mahabharata. And according to that text, when a person went to went to that place or simply thought about the lake, all his evil deeds disappeared and he obtained a reward equal to the gift of 1,000 cows, especially when he saluted the yaksha Matsya Kruka. So that's the way this is propagated. So this power of salvific power of place, just thinking about the place is enough. And then some yakshas were also transformed into Hindu gods and sages. The most famous is Kubera, who was included as the god of wealth. But another such yaksha is then Kapila. Several of the Hindu pilgrimage places associated with the well-known Sankhya sect Kapila were previously associated with a yaksha named Kapila. There are also other places. Now the Buddha sought enlightenment under a Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, and that was probably because this sacred tree was already worshipped, and the place beneath it was by that time a sacred site with a chaitya, a shrine. In some texts you'd find the statement that it was a Hindu pilgrimage place, and that's what, but I think that might be using the word Hindu in an unusual way. The worship of the tree, perhaps with its yaksha, was then redefined or reinvented, emphasizing the tree and the site's significance for the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition. So the stories, narratives of the Buddha was also, the yakshas were also included in those stories. And Buddha was also a yaksha, a tree god in previous lives. In the famous enlightenment story, I didn't check it, I take it from memory, I hope it's correct, but I think seem to remember that there was a female servant, Sujata, and she came to offer boiled rice to the tree, and then she saw the Buddha sit there, and she thought it was the yaksha tree that she saw, and offered rice to that yaksha. I mean, that's the narrative. So Buddhism was established and as similar to, but also superior to, the religion it tried to replace. This is Chopin's arguments, who has written a lot on the material culture of early Buddhism. So building stupas on places already established as sacred was strategy of expansion. The association of specific chaityas with individual yakshas, it attested in Buddhist texts, and Buddha Gosha glosses Chittiyani as Yakka Tanani, the dwelling place of yakshas. Reference to many such sites are found in the literature, and it's evidence that the Buddhists built chaityas on places that were already sacred and associated with yakshas. Now, a similar process for Hindu tradition can be seen in the Mahabharata, with yakshas and other divinities associated with pilgrimage places. So the Buddhists did this before. First, I guess there were less places left, maybe, but the process is similar. So since the pre-Buddhist non-Vedic ritual tradition did not produce texts, the earliest textual statements of religious pilgrimage and sites of pilgrimage in South Asia were found in the text of the Buddhist and the Hindu tradition. So the earliest important text that promote pilgrimage, as far as I know, is the Buddhist Mahapanibbana Sutta or the Hindu Mahabharata. And both texts indicate that the presence of the pre-Buddhist non-Vedic religious tradition was important for the development of pilgrimage traditions. So just a brief look into early Buddhist, the Mahapanibbana Sutta. This is also well known material. Ananda was worrying about what will happen when the Buddha passes away, and he says to the Buddha that after the Buddha's death it will no longer be possible for the monks to come to pay homage to him after the end of the rainy season. The Buddha then explains that honoring him after his death would still be possible, and that the monks should go to pay homage to the four sites with the same enthusiasm that they used to show to the Buddha. And these are the famous Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, Sarnath, and Kustinara. So the monks and nuns and lay people encourage them to go to these places, and the Buddha promises that they will gain religious merit from visiting these sites. I'm not claiming that this is what the Buddha said. I'm claiming that, just saying that that's what the text says. It might have been written later. or most possible. So but that's the way of Buddhist pilgrimage to these places is legitimated or explained. And the Buddha promises a rebirth in heaven as the reward of the pilgrimage. They are another who shall die while with pleasant mind. The translation of Rice David is, I think, some with a very Puritan Christian. I've forgotten what it was, but I changed it. So sojourning on such pilgrimage shall be reborn after death, when the body shall dissolve in the happy realms of heaven. So that's a kind of a salvific power of these places. And these places are also called Chetyas, so the same name used for the pre-Buddhist Yaksha shrines. Chopin considered this quoted statement I just read from the Digha Nikaya as the single most important canonical passage in the Buddhist canon. The Chetya is also used in chapter 1 of the Mahapana Nibbana Sutta, in which the Buddha explains what the Vajjayans need to do to avoid the decline of their society. One of the things they must do is to honor the Vajjayan shrines, the Chetyas, both within and outside the city, and respect, revere, and worship them. Now, the other type of pilgrimage place in the early Buddhist was the stupa. So Ananda had asked what they should do with the body after Buddha had passed away. And he answered, there are wise men, Ananda, among the nobles, the Brahmins, among the heads of houses, who are firm believers in the Tathagata, and they will do due honor to the remains of the Tathagata. Also Rice David's translation. And the Buddha explained that his body should be put in a vessel filled with oil and burned, and stupa built at crossroads. And this, the relics and the vessel and the embers were eventually divided between 8 different rulers who built stupas and organized festivals there. And according to Chopin, then the Buddha was thought to be actually present and alive in these relics at these sites. So there you have kind of a divine living presence at sites, similar to the belief about yakshas, although we don't know for sure about that, but certainly in the teaching of Hindu temple murtis. Yes, and this is just a promise about this, the salvific rewards for those who visit the stupas. Rice David's, that shall long be to them profit and joy. Now, researchers often claim that the Buddha consciously sought out certain places such as Gaya and Varanasi, that is Sarnath, which the Buddha had decided should be two of the 4 pilgrimage places connected to events of his life, because they were already sites of important Hindu pilgrimages. But I think this view is probably mistaken. There might have been pilgrimage in connection with the yaksha worship at these places, or worship of other divinities, but the Hindu pilgrimage associated with these sites later originated many centuries after the Buddha. I think Hans Bakker has shown that Benares, Varanasi, as a pilgrimage place, originated in the 6th or 7th century. Before that, it was an important commercial city. And the Shraddha rituals as Gaya is also much later compared to the Buddha. So here is just the last picture of the stupa and Sarnath. Just show that these are kind of huge buildings. Like the yakshas also attempt to make big, something big, and I hear the Sarnath also. Yes, so studies of inscriptions have shown that already at the time of Ashoka, Buddhists had established their own sacred sites, and that the most characteristic element of Buddhist sacred sites in India was the presence of a stupa. And this is again Chopin. The relics of the Buddha and the stupa symbolized his presence and were objects of worship. And in early Buddhist, then darshan of the place implied a direct intimate contact with a living presence. Now Chopin has argued that a close similarity between Hindu idea of tirthas and Buddhist stupa sites as living presence of power But as I have argued, the idea of living deities associated with the sites may very well go back to the non-Vedic pre-Buddhist substrate culture, and that the Hindu teaching of Tirtha are much later than the Buddhist stupa sites. The use of stupas for political control may explain Ashoka's eagerness for the expansion of the cult of relics. And if we look at the expansion of Hindu cult of temple images, a similar argument can be. Now, into the Brahmanical Hindu tradition. So the stupa was then, in contrast to the placelessness of the Vedic gods, a site of permanent presence of sacred power. It was now the Hindu tirthas are similar to the stupa in that they are permanently demarcated sacred places and sites of the permanent presence of a sacred power. So while the source of pilgrimage in South Asia may very well have been the pre-Buddhist non-Vedic substrate culture, the expansion of Hindu places promoted in the Tirtha Yatra Parvan of the Mahabharata, which encompasses large part of India, may probably be read as a textual response to the Ashokan and post-Ashokan expansion of Buddhist sacred sites with the construction of a large number of stupas and monastic institutions and the economic network that the Sangha represented in trade and control. So it shows, I think, attempts of Hindus to construct sacred sites of pilgrimage comparable to the Buddhists. And a continuation of this geographical expansion is described in the Puranas then, which became the most important genre of text to promote Hindu pilgrimage sites. So the Mahabharata then is an important pilgrimage text, and the longest is the Tirtha Yatra Parvan of the Aranyaka Parvan of Vana Parvan. It's quite long, chapter 78 to 148, so it's a really long text. Other major pilgrimage chapters are Nishalya Parvan, chapter 35 to 54, also quite long, Anushasana Parvan, two chapters, Adi Parvan, five chapters, Udyoga Parvan, one chapter, and then one could argue that the Maha Prashtanika Parvan and the Svarga Rohanika Parvan are both pilgrimage texts, although they do tell the story about the Pandava brothers going to the mountains and then to heaven, so, or hell, actually, and then to heaven. But it has been argued by Vasilikov that there are pilgrimage texts in all the 18 books of Mahabharata except one. So, and the argument was that it used to be entertain warriors, but that function stopped, and then the bards moved to pilgrimage places and entertained pilgrims. So that became the new kind of location of the text. So the oldest one is the Tirtha Yatra of Baladeva in Shalya Parvan. Then Tirtha Yatra Parvan was added, and then lastly the Adi Parvan. These are the three longest. And these are, the Adi Parvan and maybe the Shalya Parvan are maybe a transformation of earlier narratives into pilgrimage narratives. And these, I think I said that already, these narratives are, many of them are kind of etymological stories. They are meant for entertainment. They explain why the place has salvific power. Why is this sacred? Now, these three texts shows that there are two very different, they are all called pilgrimage texts, but they are very different forms of rituals that the two texts. And some people have argued that they see in Baladeva Salya Parvan a kind of Vedic origin of pilgrimage, that it goes back to something called the Sarasvati Satra, that it's a ritual along the Sarasvati River. But I want to argue against that. That certainly is a procession, but the kind of pilgrimage we'll see. But the other ritual and the religious travel of the Tithayatra Parvan is the ritual recommended for poor people who cannot afford to perform sacrifice. That's how it's argued. While Baladeva's Tirthayatra is a royal procession of economic redistribution. So we can discuss if that we should call that a pilgrimage or not. Or we don't know if it actually took place. Mahabharata is not a documentary. But the other one, the Tirthayatra Parvan, there you have the kind of the ridiculing of the sacrifices. There is this idea that at the pilgrimage places there is easy access of salvific rewards. So clearly there is someone else than the priests responsible for the sacrifices who are arguing for these places. So the Tirthayatra Parvan, that type of ritual is related to the Buddhist pilgrimage as present in the Mahabharata Nibbana Sutta. And it was perhaps introduced as a competitor to that kind of pilgrimage, to expand the number of Brahmanical pilgrimage sites and aid at increasing the number of ritual clients for Brahmin priests, that kind of Brahmin priest, I have to say, who functioned at these sites. And this becomes omnipresent in the Puranas. And of course the Orthodox Vedic priests did not recognize condemned this kind of priests who worked at the pilgrimage places. These two, the royal procession and the ritual of popular pilgrimage, then are two different types of purposes and functions. Now the way Baladeva's Shalya Parvan journey is described is, it is a ritual journey, and it says visit Tirthas, but it's accompanied by a performance of fire sacrifices along the rivers, and then this distribution of enormous amounts of wealth. So there are hundreds of Brahmins, there are thousands of cows following along, and redistribution of wealth seems to be the main function of this procession ritual. So that is maybe then one sort of religious travel then. They are said to visit Tirtha, but on these places they organize sacrifices. And the places are associated with Vedic recitation. And they try to connect salvific power to Vedic mythology. So maybe an attempt to Vedicize the idea of Tirthas. But it's found only that example. It's a very rare description. So it's also an explanation here that that place attained its power because a king obtained knowledge of the Veda at that place. By means of that pen. So that would be to connect salvific power to some Vedic activity, learning the Vedas. But that's very uncommon. Now, the Tirthayatra Parvan, on the other hand, ridicules these Vedic sacrifices. I mean, it kind of ridicules also the power of salvific space. It says, that's from the Tirthayatra Parvan, poor man cannot obtain the fruits of sacrifice, O king, for they require many implements and a great variety of ingredients. Kings can perform these sacrifices, sometimes rich people, not individuals lacking in means and implements and not helped by others. So that's how it's argued that pilgrimage, you should go there. Everyone can afford it. And this merit for visiting Tirthas is the same as the rewards of sacrifices. But going to Tirtha also surpasses them. And then it uses this kind of language that, you know, 10,000 crore of Tirthas are present in Pushkara. I'm unsure why it would use that kind of language, but maybe it's a way to direct it as Buddhist places, to make to make kind of the power of place a relative, that there are so many, 10,000 crores, so it kind of reduces the value of Tirthas, but it's also such that this place is unique because all Tirthas are present there. But if there are billions, I'm not sure. But it is a common way in Hindu pilgrimage to say that all rivers are present in one river, all rivers are present, all lakes are present in this one lake, all lingas are present in this one linga. So it is a way to propagate the power of that particular place, at least that's the tradition for that. Now it's very contrary also to the Vedic tradition that was very restrictive. The yagyas were only available to some. Tirtha tradition welcomes all, and it's a kind of a total, I mean, it's so much salvific power is kind of overflowing with it. So even being touched by the dust from a Tirtha blown in a wind will give you all, fulfill all wishes. In Tirthayatra Pairavan, the purpose seems to propagate salvific rewards of these places, especially to encourage people to become ritual clients of the Brahmins or the priests at these places and provide them with dana. So there are also then rituals coming up at these places. In a short narrative of in Adi Pairavan, that's the about actually Apsaras and Apsarases and Nagas, and they suffer from a spell, so Arjuna kind of relieves them from that spell and they become again beautiful Apsarases. But the story becomes now an etymological story. It explains the name of that Tirtha, Nari Tirtha, the Tirtha of women. So it explains why is it called the Tirtha of women. The suggestion is that this has been rewritten, that it was really about something else, Arjuna and these women, but now it has become a story to explain the name Nari Tirtha and why it is a pilgrimage place. A common argument here is that at some point of time it was a matter of survival for many Brahmin priests to accept anyone as their ritual clients. Women and low caste had not been welcome at the Vedic sacrifice, were welcomed at the Tirthas. The ritual Tirthayatra was only reluctantly accepted in the Brahmanical tradition. Perhaps then out of economic necessity, maybe also for reasons of power, when the temple pilgrimage become powerful, that changed the situation. And by the 5th century temple Hinduism, with temple priests living murtis, puja, and the system of land grants were added, and that was a really powerful combination made Hinduism expand, the Sangha, economic network of the Buddhist Sangha, then gradually losing out for this new system of temple Hinduism. The priests traveled widely, spreading the cause of image worship among the ruling classes, and the purpose was to garner land grants in favor of their religious activities and to develop an infrastructure that effectively countered the support system developed by Buddhists for the Sangha. This is Willis who argues in this archaeology of a Hindu ritual. And then they succeeded. Many temples became important Tirthas. Conclusion then, just this is the last slide. the Vedic Brahmins did accept the ritual of the Tirthayatra only at the beginning of the second millennium. For the first time it was introduced in a Dharmashastra tradition, in a volume in the 12th century Tirtha Vivechanakanda, which was a volume in Vikritya Kalpa Taru of Lakshmidara. I think that was like 12 volumes. And so before that, there is not it was not part of the Dharmashastra, so not part of what Orthodox Vedic priests considered Dharma. In the Tirtha Vivechanakanda, there is almost all the material is from the Mahabharata and the Puranas. There is some short material also from Dharmashastra, but hardly any. So when the Brahmins of the Orthodox Dharmashastra tradition finally accepted the tradition of Tirthas, the Tirthas were widespread throughout India, and so at that time, 12th century, we can then think of Tirthayatra as a mainstream ritual being fully incorporated into the Hindu tradition. And of course, why it happened then, there are been arguments for that also. I think one argument might be that the temple traditions, the Hindu temple traditions, had been so powerful, that is the tantric tradition, the Agama traditions, that at that time the Vedic were so weak that they couldn't do anything else. There have been arguments also that at that time the Muslims had crushed Benares several times, so it might have been a way to territorialize. I mean, then the need to territorialize Hindu territory. So I think the last explanation is an unpleasant one. Therefore, there have been a search for other explanations, and then the explanation that the temple traditions were now so powerful. I mean, these were big. By that time, you had the full-blown Hindu temple traditions with the land grants, etc. And these Vedic priests, in a way, had no other choice. One could also say that Lakshmidara, he functioned in Benares, who by at that time had become an important pilgrimage city. So when he got this job, he was maybe also asked to include it by the sponsor. That's also a possibility. But I think that's the historical outline of how I see it. So I think that's my presentation today.